This morning we're going to look at the banishment of Yishmael and Hagar. And I thought that we would look at it particularly through the lens of the Midrash. And so I brought I'm going to explain again what the Midrash is and where it comes from. And I hope that that will... Also, you'll see the seeds of a lot of biblical interpretation in what the Midrash does. But first, let's read over the story very briefly. It's a few psukim, a few sentences, and recall the background is that now that Sarah has a son, she doesn't need Yishmael around anymore. She has someone else who can, you know, get her slippers and... take out the trash. So, and Yishmael obviously is competition for inheritance. And that really is probably the central issue, in addition to just the emotional distress of seeing Abraham's other kid. This is what we would call today a blended family. But this blended family, the issue is who's going to inherit. And as long as Yishmael's around, he inherits. And as we saw last time, Nachum Sarna, who wrote this commentary, the JPS commentary, brings a source that suggests that law of the ancient Near East allowed someone to effectively banish a child, and if you banished a child, they didn't inherit. So if Sarah can get Abraham to banish Yishmael, and you notice that Sarah doesn't do it by herself. She doesn't just send Yishmael away. Instead, she must persuade Abraham to send Yishmael away because the legal rights are his to exercise or to give up. If she can get Abraham to send Yishmael away, then Isaac will inherit. And that's obviously both what she wants and presumably what God wants, since God endorses the plan. Okay. So, verse 9. Sarah saw the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had borne to Abraham playing, mitzachek. And we talked extensively last time about what playing means. We're chapter 21, verse 9. I'm not going to go back over it except to mention that because of other uses of the word playing in the Bible, there's a reason to give it a negative connotation. She said to Abraham, "Cast out that slave woman and her son, for the son of that slave shall not share in the inheritance with my son Isaac." Now, notice the difference between, first of all, the way she refers to Yishmael in terms of the slave, and also, what doesn't she call Yishmael?
Or Ishmael,
right. And the contrast is sharpened by the fact that she says, "my son Isaac." I mean, Yishmael now is about 16 years old by biblical chronology. She knows his name, right? She's been living with him for 16 years. But she only refers to him as your son. As her son, not as your son. So
even in the beginning, Sarah saw the son whom Hagar the Egyptian
right.
had born to Abraham.
Because that's who she saw. She actually didn't see Abraham's son. She saw Hagar, the Egyptian's son, playing. In the same way that you, and this is true, if you have a rival, you don't see the mother or the sister, you see the rival. And it's the same person, but that's not who you see, right? We also categorize people according to their function. It's why, when you were a kid and you went to the supermarket and you saw your teacher in the supermarket, you thought they don't belong here. They're not supposed to be here, right? They're only supposed to be in the classroom. Because we do compartmentalize what people are. And here, the only thing she sees is the son of Hagar. She doesn't see anything else. Which you can understand, must be pretty hard for Yishmael. And probably hard for Isaac, too. But we'll come back to that. The matter distressed Abraham greatly, for it concerned a son of his, right? Even though Sarah might not recognize that, Abraham certainly does. But God said to Abraham, "Do not be distressed over the boy or your slave, Whatever Sarah tells you, do as she says, for it is through Isaac that offspring shall be continued for you. As for the son of the slave woman, I'll make a nation of him too, for he is your seed. Okay? I'm doing it for you. I'm going to make him a nation. And he's mentioned, Yishmael is mentioned only twice more, by the way, in the Torah. And after the book of Genesis, I don't think is mentioned at all, if I'm not mistaken. But obviously, you know, Islam claims Yishmael as its forefather, so the line of Yishmael has a profound effect on history. Early next morning, Abraham took some bread and a skin of water and gave them to Hagar. He placed them over her shoulder. We'll come to that in a minute, what that means. He placed them over her shoulder together with the child and sent her away. When the water was gone from, and she wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba. When the water was gone from the skin, she left the child under one of the bushes and went and sat down at a distance, a bow shot away. For she thought, let me not look on as the child dies. And sitting thus afar, she burst into tears. God heard the cry of the boy, and an angel of God called to Hagar from heaven and said to her, what troubles you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heeded the cry of the boy where he is. Come, lift up the boy and hold him by the hand, for I will make a great nation of him. Then God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. She went and filled the skin with water and let the boy drink. God was with the boy, and he grew up. He dwelt in the wilderness and became a bowman. He lived in the wilderness of Paran, and his mother got a wife for him from the land of Egypt. Okay, there's the whole story. Now, there is a lot here to look at. So now that we've heard the story, let's go back over, in particular, with the eye of the Midrash. Okay, let's start at 21:11, because that's, I believe, where we stopped last time. The matter distressed Abraham greatly, okay? And it's Be'enei Avraham. It's literally, the matter was very bad in Abraham's eyes. Okay? So what he saw, and presumably there is a hint here that he saw what was going on. You know, he really understood what Sarah's reaction was, and maybe even he saw his own part in it, because he clearly had an integral part in creating this situation, right? He agreed to have a child with Hagar. That was his choice. Anyway, so Al Odot Benof, they translate it as for it concerned a son of his, but you could just say because of what happened with his son. But then God tells him, don't be distressed. Al Hana'ar vi Al Amatcha. Now, first of all, what is a Na'ar? A lad. Like a 16-year-old could be called a Na'ar. That does make sense, okay? And remember that, at least in theory, according to biblical chronology, is Yishmael's age here. Although before this, he's not referred to as a Na'ar. This is the first time, I think, before that he's called Asher Yaldal Avraham Mitzachek, the one who was born to Abraham and Hagar, was playing. But that is, in fact, what he is. But why shouldn't you worry about him? He said, everything Sarah tells you, you should listen to. Ki bi Yitzchak, in Isaac, right? Yikra lecha zera, yikare lecha zera. In Isaac, your offspring will be called, okay? And the bet, bi Yitzchak, the Midrash explains. Every time the Midrash finds a letter that doesn't absolutely have to be there, because you could say, for Isaac will be your offspring, or Isaac will produce your offspring. So why does it say in Isaac? Okay? Now, the Midrash, which I'm going to start reading from and read you several selections from, this one is called Midrash Rabbah. When someone says the Midrash, they usually mean Midrash Rabbah. Midrash is a collection of interpretations of the Bible that were written by the rabbis of the Talmud. Some of it is found in the Talmud, some of it is found in other collections called Midrashim. And they were written between probably 100 BCE and about 800 or 900 CE. And the reason we know that they go that late is some of the later Midrashim have Islamic influences, Islamic names, references to Islamic customs, so we know that it was post-Islam. But most of them were written by rabbis either in Rome or in Babylonia during the time of the Roman Empire. And a lot of what we hear as biblical interpretation comes from the Midrash. And what the rabbis did was comb over the biblical text again and again and again and try to find hints not only of things that were left out, but also things that supported their own worldview. I mean, for example, the rabbis believed in a world to come. The Sadducees, who were another group around the same time, did not believe in a world to come. So the rabbis, every chance they got, tried to prove that the Bible believes in a world to come. And here is a good example. How many is bet in Hebrew? Two. So it says, Rabbi Azariah said in the name of Bar Chutach, the bet denotes two. That is, your seed will be called in him who recognizes the existence of two worlds and will inherit two worlds. That's why it says B, right, exactly. That's right. Well, stretching is what the Midrash does. A lot of Midrashim are stretching, but it's only, you know, it's stretching if you don't believe that God, it's not stretching, rather, if you do believe that God wrote every word of the Bible and it is infinitely interpretable because God put infinite meanings in it. So almost anything you find in it, of course God meant that, because in this one bet there are probably 100 other interpretations that God had in mind that we just haven't thought of yet. So it depends how you, if you look at it otherwise, then it's certainly stretching. And sometimes there's a biblical interpreter named the Torah Tamima, Rabbi Baruch Epstein, who sometimes at the end of one or another of his interpretations, he's very, very, very extraordinarily smart. He'll give an interpretation, and then he'll have a little abbreviation, which is Dalid Vav Kuf, which stands for Vav Dalid Kuf, rather, Vidochek Ketzat, which means, and it's a little forced, you know? So he admits it, but he wants, if he comes up with something clever, he doesn't want to not put it down, but he wants you to know that he realizes that, you know, it's a little forced. So this is Dochek Ketzat. Anyway. All right. And then verse 13. Thanks. I learned from my daughter. They teach them now to sneeze into your elbow, not into your hands. Because you shake people's hands and you touch things with your hands. And much better that you should sneeze into your elbow where you don't, right, you don't generally turn the light on with your elbow. So, all right. As for the son of the slave woman, I will make a nation of him too, because he is your seed. All right. Now, Vayashkem Avraham Baboker. Abraham woke up early in the morning. Okay? Can you think of any other time Abraham wakes up early in the morning? In one chapter that's the same, that theme is going to be picked up, that Abraham woke up early in the morning for the binding of Isaac. So, and the reason I mention it here is he's waking up early for Ishmael, he's waking up early for Isaac, and both times, in a way, he's sacrificing his son, which is a very powerful motif. Yeah, very powerful. And then it says, what does he get? And he takes bread and a skin of water and gives them to Hagar. Now, you can see bread and water both ways. I mean, you can see it as, you know, generous or ungenerous, although the Midrash, of course, sees it as generous. But what I wanted to mention is, who would normally get the food for somebody who was leaving for a journey?
The mom,
right? You know, if the kid goes off to camp, it's rarely the father who gets up and packs the meal for them to go, right? And in fact, the kid doesn't want the father to pack the meal because they know they'll get a better meal if mom packs the meal, right? Dad packs the meal, they'll get three Twinkies, you know? But if mom packs the meal, they'll get a sandwich. But you notice that Sarah is not doing this, right? She's totally out of the loop. She's in bed sleeping. She says, just make sure they're not here when I get up. But here's the the interesting part of this is it says that he took the water and gave it to Hagar, and then it says, "Sam al shichma ve'et hayeled ve'yishal chayha," which means he took all the stuff, he gave it to Hagar, and I'm going to translate it literally. Put on her shoulders and the boy and sent her. So the question is, what did he put on her shoulders? That's the logical thing, but if you wanted to say that, you wouldn't have such a strange construction, and it seems as though, and this is what the Midrash says, he put the boy on her shoulders. Right. But the problem is, of course, that Yishmael is 16. So why would you put a 16-year-old on? Now, it makes sense. Remember that the Bible doesn't always follow chronology, okay? So in some ways, even from the fact that Yishmael is dying and he's had a bow shot away and so on, it seems like he's a little kid in this story. And the Bible sometimes does that, right? Isaac is, in fact, in his 30s chronologically during the Akedah, but he feels like a 12-year-old when you read the story. And the rabbis often say that the chronology of the Torah is not reliable. But here again, I want to just show you how the Midrash works. The Midrash knows all of this. The rabbis are aware of everything we just said, profoundly aware of it. So this is how they interpret it. Okay. Put it on her shoulder. He was 27 years old. They say 27, although 14. He was 14 at Isaac's birth. So if Isaac's 13-year-old, he's 27. Yet you say putting it on her shoulders and the child. This, however, teaches. Are you ready for something that, again, is an implausible teaching but ties everything together that we know? All right? Sarah cast an evil eye on him, whereupon he was seized with feverish pains and could not walk. The proof of this lies in the verse. Read, keep reading. Sent her away, and she wandered about in the wilderness of Beersheba. When the water was gone from the skin, she left the child under one of the bushes. And the water and the bottle was gone. A sick person drinks frequently. So it ties everything together. The fact that the bottle, the you presume Abraham gave them enough water, but quickly the water is gone. Yishmael gets put on his shoulders. Yishmael is old. Sarah isn't there to see them off. And all of that is wrapped up. Now, if I said to you, if we hadn't gone over this, and I just said to you, by the way, there's a midrash that Sarah gave him an evil eye and he was sick, you'd think, oh, that's cute. But you realize that usually when you hear a rabbinic interpretation, it's because they're trying to explain things in the Bible that are not easy to explain. Like, why is this strange construction about putting everything on the shoulders there? Now, I heard someone mention the idea of, you mentioned the idea of what it means to have, that he was on her shoulders, now he was her responsibility. That's also a very nice interpretation and might work here. Yeah. Right.
So, and you're saying that it's not always the right order, chronological order. It could be that, when we talked about the Bible being written in different places and this and that, could it be that this is put here but maybe related to that story?
Well, it's clear, it is clearly related to that story in some ways. It's not exactly what they call a doublet. There are some portions of the Bible that repeat each other almost exactly with variations. But this, if you compare this story to that story, I mean, part of the great difference, of course, is that they never come back. You know, this is it. And also that here, the angel saves them and promises them a future, whereas you remember what the angel did last time when they were sent out? Sends them back. Because the time wasn't right yet. And also now, the function of Abraham's son has been filled. He no longer needs Yishmael. I mean, he wants Yishmael around, obviously, but it's not the same. Yeah. The Midrash takes the evil eye very seriously. And all sorts of... The Midrash takes the what we think of as the superstitious side of Judaism very seriously. The rabbis are full of magic and miracle and all that stuff. I can give you lots and lots of examples. There are now a number of books about it, but the folk magic, superstition, practices that most modern Jews think of as not particularly Jewish. In fact, you know, all through Judaism. We're all through Judaism. I mean, people, you know, spitting and people warding off the evil eye and all those sorts of things. I think I told the story here once before, but just in my family, the sort of paradigmatic story, the one that everybody used to tell, is that when my mother was pregnant with my brother, she was watching TV and there was a circus or something and these monkeys came on and my great-grandmother like leapt in front of the TV so she wouldn't see the monkeys, because then of course her, you know, great-grandson would come out a monkey. Everybody knew that. So yeah, they absolutely, yes. Yes, it does. Little kids on their shoulders, sure. Yep, I know. Yep.
And then also she's living under the bush. You know, a bush isn't very big.
Right. I know. The feel of the story is clearly that he's a little kid. There's no doubt about it. If he's a 16-year-old, he could survive at least as well as his mother in the wilderness, you would think. The other, by the way, you know, when you say Mazal Tov, what are mazalot? Constellations, right. You're basically wishing somebody good stars when you say mazal tov. In fact, idolaters in the Talmud are called ovdei, workers or servants, ovdei, mazalot, ukochavim. People who serve constellations and stars. So akum, ovdei kochavim u'mazalot. Akum is the abbreviation for idolaters. So mazal tov is, again, magic and astrology working its way into Judaism. Maimonides has a long argument against astrology, but you don't argue against something if people don't believe in it. You know? So, yeah.
I've read this many, many times, and every time I read it, I see a Hollywood movie, and I don't understand.
Why it hasn't been made?
No. Oh. What I see is Abraham, not a slave, bringing one container of water, apparently a skin, and some bread, and sends her out along with the boy. A slave doesn't bring them supplies. They're not given donkeys or camels or slaves to escort them. This act of Abraham's has to, in some respects, be very willful with it, either knowledge or hope, that they will disappear and die. You can't believe they're going to make it.
You only if you think that he didn't hear God say, do it.
He's questioned God many times before. He's argued that.
But not when God gives him a direct order.
Yeah, I know.
God said, listen to what she said, send them off, I'll make them a great nation.
But he didn't say send them off alone and empty
hands. I have no idea what he said send them off. I mean, he doesn't,
Can I play Midrashim here?
Sure.
Something got left out. Also, I'm fascinated by your use of the word bait. Because it seems to me that at this very moment, two worlds were created. The Jewish world became the Jewish world, and for want of a better word, a non-Jewish world. And they've lived side by side. Didn't they peek at each other out of the corner of their eye? Didn't they follow each other? Didn't they know each other? Exactly?
Well, here we're playing, I think, retroactive history. Because look, Yishmael created a people called the Ishmaelites. The Ishmaelites were gone by the time of the rabbis. The rabbis predated, by the turn of the Common Era, there were no more Yishmaelites. Nobody ever heard of the Yishmaelites. They don't exist in rabbinic times. They've long since perished in biblical times or disappeared along with the Perizzites and the Canaanites and everybody else. 700 years later, there's the Islamic people that claim their descent from the Ishmaelites. But to say that they were in fact created at this moment is, I would say, mythologically, yes, but historically, I think you have a hard slog to prove that. And also, there was already a non-Jewish world. Abraham didn't create it. What Abraham created was a Jewish world. But it's an interesting, I mean, look, I think that there's a lot to, if you want to indict Abraham, there's a lot to indict Abraham and Sarah about the treatment of their family. That's pretty clear. But God does seem to endorse it, even if God doesn't say, you know, send them off with few provisions. God does seem to endorse the basic, which is, and when she, and also, but the Midrash also, by the way, the Midrash picks up on this, which is nice. The rabbis, you know, the rabbis do have a tendency to make bad their enemies. But here, it says, when it says, and went and sat down at a distance, a bow shot away, Rabbi Berechia says, the phrase a bow shot away, which in the Hebrew is kim mitach, I'm trying to read it in the transliteration, and I can't read it in the translation. Kim mitachave, he translates kim mitachet, which is as one who criticizes. He says the phrase connotes a woman who impugns God's justice. In other words, like a bow shot against God. Because yesterday, she says, you promised I will greatly multiply your seed, and now he's dying of thirst. Because the first time that Yishmael was sent out, that's what she was promised, right? That his seed would be greatly multiplied. And now he's dying of thirst, so she doesn't believe God's promise, which again is a parallel with whom?
Sarah
and Abraham. We're also promised. Remember, Abraham's promised you're going to be a great nation, and then he says to God, how can I be a great nation? I don't have any kids. Then God gives him Yishmael. Yishmael gets sent out. God says to Yishmael, Hagar, you're going to become a great nation. And now God's killing Hagar's son. And so you see that maybe part of what's going on here is God makes promises. The promises seem as though they're going to be destroyed at the very inception of the promise. But miraculously, they're saved and they come true. Because it comes true with Yishmael. And it comes true with Avraham. It just seems like it's not going to. So,
see Abraham as grief-stricken, that he's not in his right mind, wait, maybe he didn't even sleep.
Yeah.
He got up so early.
Right.
And then he's not in his right mind to just send someone with somebody.
It could be. I certainly think the fact that he's forced to do this would make him, yeah. I agree with you, but that doesn't, you do both. You read it literally, historically, but you also read it metaphorically. Yeah, which is, I don't know of any school of interpretation that's dedicated to denying the Yishmaelan birth of Islam. But in the course of a class, when someone talks about it, we ought to at least remind ourselves that this is, I think, a speculative lineage at best. But fine. I mean, it's true. Certainly, everybody has a right to claim a spiritual lineage from whatever group they want to claim. But I don't think, I think that it's putting too much, I mean, it isn't. In some ways, it's putting too much on poor Abraham to say that this was the moment when he split the world in two. Although there's some truth to it in the sense that the earlier you are in history, the more influence you have in history. You know, that's just the nature of it. Alexander the Great had more influence than Napoleon because without an Alexander the Great, there wouldn't have been a Napoleon.
One thing from my reading is Abraham didn't split the world into God. In other words, if God did it through Sarah and through Hagar,
yeah.
Abraham,
well,
then Abraham is not wanting the world to be split into
two. One thing that is... One thing that's interesting about this class is that we go back and forth on that. You know, sometimes we want it to be the human element, and sometimes we want it to be the God element. And I mean, I do too. I do the exact same thing, so I'm not. So yes, either God or Abraham, depending on how you want to read it at that moment. But or Sarah, for that matter. You could blame it on Sarah if you want. What's that? Yes, but that's, yeah. Go ahead.
On that note, so often for the past years, I hear people telling me, basically it was God's fault that all this world is divided in two.
Right.
God created the glories and divided,
right.
And it's coming back here again.
Yeah. Well, I would say, I mean, you know, it's, first of all, it's so interesting always to hear Jews speak about the world as Jews and Goyim, you know, because they're like 0.001% of Jews, and then there's everybody else. I think that, you know, if you go to the average, I don't know, Hindu, they probably don't say, well, you know, I'm a Goy. So the world is divided up into more than two. It's divided up into lots and lots of different groups. That's what the Tower of Babel story is intended to illustrate. But it, I would say, rather than at a moment, it's built into the nature of human beings. I mean, you all have kids in school. How soon do cliques form? That's just to divide oneself off, and also to reach out. Both impulses are very powerful in people. And we're always, you know, we're always going back and forth about them, always trying to decide what groups we belong to, how embracing those groups are. And also, you belong to lots of different groups. I mean, you're the same person can be, you know, a Jew and a mother and, a writer and a traveler and a cook and a lot of other things. And you have so many different worlds, right, that you're a part of. It's a very, it's just complicated to be a person. Yeah.
There's a pun, maybe there's a pun here, but you used the word several times, Boshan. She set a bow, and Hagar set a distance of a bow shot away. And Ishmael becomes a bowman.
Right, that's exactly intended.
So
yeah.
There had to be clearly, there's,
yes.
We're being taught something.
Yes, right.
You defined a bow shot as an attack on God?
I didn't define it.
Well,
the Midrash did.
The Midrash
said that that's why that term was used. Right, but it also will, everybody more or less assumes that the metaphor of the bow, especially with Mitzachek earlier, which we talked about last week, is that's the theme of Yishmael's life. He's a hunter. So, the other thing that I really want to make sure that we see here is, it says, when the water was gone from the skin, I'm in verse 15, she left the child under one of the bushes and went and sat down at a distance, a bow shot away, for she thought, let me not look on as the child dies. And sitting thus afar, she burst into tears. Now again, she doesn't call him Na'ar here. She calls him Yelet. She calls him a little boy, right? A Yelet is a little boy. So was he a Na'ar or a Yelet, or was he just a Yelet to her? I don't know. But then it says, God heard the cry of the boy and an angel called to Hagar. Now what's strange about that sentence? What's that? He wasn't crying, at least not as far as we know. So, again, the Midrash, right? Because obviously they noticed it. And the angel of God called to Hagar. Let's see. Well, there's another nice little thing there, but I'll skip it for the moment. It says, when he heard the child crying, it says, the sick person's prayers on his own behalf count more than those of anyone else. God responds not to his mother's cry, but to his cry, because your own cry on your own behalf is more powerful than someone else's cry on your behalf. That's what God most responds to. And it says then, we've talked about this before, it says in verse 17, what troubles you, Hagar? Fear not, for God has heeded the cry of the boy where he is, Ba'asher Husham. And this is a famous rabbinic interpretation. Rabbi Shimon said, the angels said to God, sovereign of the universe, why would you bring a well, because God produces this magical well, to for one who will one day slay your children with thirst? In other words, the Ishmaelites will one day attack, and you can see this in Isaiah, anyway, it's an interpretation, but the idea is that the Arabs, who are considered descendants of the Ishmaelites, attacked the Jews, according to an interpretation of a verse in Isaiah. And God answered, "Where is he now?" That's what God said to the angels. In other words, what's Ishmael's moral position at the moment? And they said, "Righteous." And he said, "I judge a man only where he is at the moment. Ba'asher hu sham, where he is." In other words, I'm not going to judge him for what he'll do later in his life. I've got to judge him now for what he does now. And therefore, God gives him a well. And I like this very much. It says, "Come, lift the boy, hold him by the hand, for I'll make a great nation of him." And then verse 19, it says, and by the way, notice that he's only promised a nation. He's not promised a land, right? With Isaac gets both. He says, "I'm going to make you a great nation and give you a land." Ishmael just gets to become a great nation. He only gets the rest of the land in the Middle East. He gets the oil, and we get the land. Lucky us. "And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water." Okay? Benjamin ben Levi and Rabbi Yochanan ben Amram both said, "All may be presumed to be blind until God, blessed be he, enlightens their eyes. And God opened her eyes, and she saw." In other words, the well was already there. She just didn't see it. God's miracle was in enabling her to open her eyes. And so they say that's true of all of us. All of us may be presumed to be blind until our eyes are opened. "And she went and filled the bottle with water." And here, you know, they have to give, they don't want Hagar to be as good as Sarah. Okay, so when it says she filled the bottle with water, what does the Midrash say? This proves she was lacking in faith. Why is she lacking in faith? No, but because she had to fill the bottle. She should have known God would provide her with water. To fill the bottle is to say, "I better keep some with me just in case it runs out." Okay, I grant you, not very nice, but... Ah, that's a nicer interpretation than this one, yes.
We are supposed to interpret it like that.
Ah, perfect. Oh my God, I could have actually. Listen.
I said right. Okay, today's Monday. I took my daughter.
Right. I'll explain exactly what you're asking exactly. First of all, this is right, which is a debate that the rabbis discuss extensively and actually comes right into the next comment, okay? Verse 15. I'm sorry, not verse 15, verse 20. It says it says, "Vayihi Elohim et Hana'ar," okay? And God was with the boy. Now, et, how do you translate the word et? You can't. There is no English translation. When you say something in Hebrew, I have to say, "I pick up et the pencil." Okay? That's just the way Hebrew works. It's an untranslatable particle, okay, of speech. So the question is, if you have to say in Hebrew, "I pick up et the pencil," the et is really superfluous. You don't really need it, right? You could take the et out and the sentence would still work. You with me? Okay. Rabbi Ishmael asked Rabbi Akiva, and by the way, this is exactly to your point. There's a whole book about your question, and it involves Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Akiva, and I'll talk about it in a second. "Since you've studied 22 years under Nachum of Gamzo," this is all Midrash, "who interpreted every ach and rak and et and gam," he interpreted every one of them and explained what everyone meant. "Tell me, what about the et written here? What's this et supposed to mean?" Now, Rabbi Ishmael asked Rabbi Akiva because Rabbi Ishmael thinks that the Torah is written the way you said. Rabbi Ishmael is the one who said, "Torah dibra bilshon b'nei adam," the Torah is written in the language of human beings. If it says et, it's because that's the way you write. And Rabbi Ishmael did not interpret the Torah the way we're interpreting it. The one who did was Rabbi Akiva, under the influence of his teacher, Nachum of Gamzo. And the reason that we read Torah that way is because Rabbi Akiva won that argument. He said, look, God wrote the Torah so there is nothing superfluous in it. It's not like when a person writes a diary. When you write a diary, so you don't pay attention to, but when God writes the Torah, everything is deliberate. And I must say, before I go on, my father once took a class with Philip Reif. Philip Reif is, he's quite old now. Actually, I just published a book, but he's one of the world's experts on Freud. They spent the entire semester analyzing an 8-page essay by Freud. And Reif said, at the beginning of the semester, he said, if you want to know how to read a great writer, study Talmud. He said, because when Freud wrote his essays, like any great writer, he spent time over every single word. And he chose this word and not that word. And if you're going to read him properly, you can't read him the way you read a street sign. You have to ask yourself, why did Freud write this instead of that? Because Freud's at least as bright as we are. And if we can ask, why did he choose this word instead of that word, it must have occurred to him. So Akiba is taking that principle and making to the nth degree. And he even interpreted the crowns on top of the Torah. And I'll tell you a story about that in a second. And if the text said, now I'm going back to, this is Akiba's answer. Remember, Rabbi Yishmael said, why does it say, and God was with et the Na'ar, okay? If the text said, and God was with the lad, it would be unintelligible, he replied. It means that, and here you go, I forgot this, or and this is for you. Et means that with him were donkey drivers, camel drivers, and his household. Because they didn't want to think that Abraham sent him out with nothing. So the et means all those other people. Yeah, no, well, that's too. You would if you'd been alive in rabbinic times, but they beat you to it. And he right, and he exactly etc. They're using it as an etc. And then it says, and he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran. Rabbi Isaac said, throw a stick in the air, and it'll fall back to the place of its origin. Thus it is written, and she had a handmaid, an Egyptian, whose name was Hagar. And here it is written, and his mother took him a wife from where?
Egypt.
She went back to her place of origin, Hagar. She came from Egypt. She went back to Egypt. Now, two things. One is about the book and the other is about the story. So Abraham Joshua Heschel wrote a book that was just translated this year into English by Gordon Tucker. It's 3 volumes in Hebrew. It's one about 900-page book in English called Torah Min HaShemayim V'Aspek Laria Shel HaDorot. Torah from the heavens in the view of generations. I think it's called Heavenly Torah through something of generations. Anyway, I have it up in my office. It's all about how the Talmud and rabbinic interpretation divides between the students of Rabbi Yishmael and the students of Rabbi Akiva. And the basic divide is the way they understand the Torah to be written. Rabbi Yishmael was less mystical, less superstitious, less interpretive. He was sort of what we would think of as commonsensical. He said the reason it says it this way is because that's how Hebrew's written. And so what Heschel was doing was he was saying we've lost too much of Rabbi Yishmael's legacy and we have to reclaim some of it. And the story that illustrates this, which is a story that you can take lots of different ways, is an amazing story from the rabbis. Moses comes to God and there's a whole preamble and gets put in the Beit Midrash, in the house of study of Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva starts interpreting the Torah the way Rabbi Akiva interprets it. He even interprets the crowns on the Torah. Because the way the preamble to the story, part of it is that Moses sees God putting the crowns on the Torah. You know how some of the Hebrew letters, when you look at the actual Torah scroll, have little markings on them, like crowns. They're called tagim. So Moses says, why are you putting that on top of the letters? And God says, one day there's going to come a rabbi who's going to interpret even the crowns on top of the letters. Moses says, could I see him? So God says, yes, and he puts him in the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva starts talking and talking and talking, and Moses doesn't understand a word. Okay? Which is the rabbi's, I think, acknowledgement that a lot of what they were saying wasn't exactly directly, right? So he's getting more and more upset and more discouraged. And then finally, someone asks Rabbi Akiva, how do we know this law, Rabbi? And Akiva says, this is the law that Moses gave us at Sinai. And Moses feels better, because he knows that, in fact, it's all part of a chain of tradition, even if he didn't originally understand what it was about. So there is the rabbis using, on the one hand, there's a sort of recognition that, yes, it is forced, some of the stuff we're saying. In fact, they talk about the laws of keeping kosher and the laws of keeping Shabbos as mountains hanging by a hair, right? All these, they've got all these laws and one little biblical verse that you hang it on. But at the other time, they also think it's legitimate, because God gave us this Torah, and the whole point of having a Torah is to interpret it and to understand it and to make it grow and so on, and that's what Rabbi Akiva does. So, you know, that's the way the tradition has read it. And anything you find in the Torah, even if it seems very subtle, is legitimate if you can make a decent case for it. Yeah. Right.
Your means should be proper.
And yes.
The disturbing thing is that Abraham does despicable things several times, actually.
Yeah.
That most of us today would not do. And so when did this switch?
Well, okay. So I agree with you. The tradition tries to get him out of it, right? The tradition tries to argue that, in fact, what he did was okay. You know, I mean, for example, the fact that they say, well, he did really give her camels and donkeys and so on, that you can see the rabbis trying to make it all right. The other question is, you know, is there anything immoral if God approves of it? Can God approve of something and it still be immoral? And the question there is, well, is something moral because God says it's moral, or is something moral and then God's opinion is separate from it? Because if things are moral just because God said so, God said this is what he should do, so it's moral.
But I think that most of us,
right, aren't there. So if that's true, then I would say what you're seeing here is early attempts by spiritual geniuses who still live in their time to grapple with great questions. And the reason, in part, that we can judge them is because of the legacy they left us. You know, because there was an Abraham and everything that followed from Abraham, we can understand that what Abraham did is not what he ought to have done. I would say that that's probably the best that we can do, is when you look back at the origin of any great tradition, you're going to find things that the later tradition would condemn. And the reason that the later tradition would condemn it is because it has the benefit of the experience of all the earlier traditions. Right.
That's a means to justify the goal justifies the means,
right.
and incredible tragedies that happen because of that. So why would God put himself outside of the law, and the Akedah is nearly the same story?
Maybe. Yeah, but I don't know, unless it is because we're designed to grapple with it. Yeah. I don't know. Yes.
Sort of. But when you look at this, literally, there's a story about Ishmael, and in this chapter, the name Ishmael is important.
Right.
It's always the son, and I mean, it's so strange to have a whole story about a casting out, it's a sacrificial story, and it's not the name of Ishmael.
Right. Well, he's not just here. The reason Rabbi Ishmael is all over the Midrash and all over the Talmud. He's one of the most prominent rabbis in Talmudic history. So, right. It's ironic, but I don't think it's, you know, I could pick another section of the Bible and Rabbi Ishmael would be there too. What is interesting and what is not known for sure is, why is there a Rabbi Ishmael but there's no Rabbi Moses? Which is a strange thing. Talmudic names, it's very interesting. But there isn't a Rabbi Moshe in the Talmud, but there is a Rabbi Ishmael. And there are other names, too, that would seem improbable. There are a lot of Greek names right, in the Talmud. But Rabbi Alexander is not an uncommon name. Right. Yes. In the whole section. Yep. Yep. Yeah. He's an extra in a way. Yeah.
Talking about Rabbi Ishmael, I just wanted to interpret him as Cain as it is. And Rabbi Akiva, that when a rabbi, your business is being a rabbi.
Yeah.
And you have to market it. I mean, I think in
there's something to that. Right. It is. I mean, it's not only is rabbinic interpretation a great marketing tool, but I'll tell you another great marketing tool. I mean, I don't mean to make it just that, but so is halacha. If I tell you the halacha of Passover is very complicated, very complicated, what are you going to do every Passover? You're going to come to me and say, what do I do? Which keeps me in business, right? But I would say, but let me interpret it slightly differently. I would say this. Instead of a marketing tool, I would say it's what rabbis do, in the sense that, let's say you're a clothing designer. The truth is, people don't need clothing designed differently from what they've already got. I mean, you know, we have like enough varieties of shirts and shoes and pants and everything else, but that's what you do. And if you're going to have an outlet for your creativity in the world, you got to design clothes. So a rabbi comes to the Torah and if he's got any creative spark, he doesn't want to say, well, you know, everything interesting's already been said, I may as well just repeat it. He wants to find something of his own, because that's what he does. It keeps people engaged. And right, so all those factors, I think, are there. But yeah, it's true. You know, if your explanation is a kind of Marxist explanation, which is it's driven economically. And that's always, you know, follow the money is always sound advice. So. Nice. That's a nice interpretation. There you go. So you could be a rabbi. I want to say one more thing. I'm so glad I looked at my notes, because this goes to exactly what you were saying about Yishmael's name. Robert Alter makes a beautiful point. What does Yishmael mean? God will hear. Right? Yishmael. God will hear. And Alter says that even though Yishmael's name isn't mentioned, the echo of the meaning of his name is all through the chapter. God will hear, right? He gets thrown out to the wilderness. God will hear, and God does hear. And that's a very beautiful notion, right? Isn't that nice?
That's what Moby Dick begins with.
Yeah. Call me Ishmael. Right. Call me Ishmael.
By the way, we did get another Moses.
No, I said, well, I didn't say we didn't get another Moses. I said no. None of the rabbis in the Talmud called Rabbi Moshe. Right, there have been other people throughout Jewish history who've been named Moses. Moses Maimonides, Moses Montefiore. Right. There have been a few Moseses, but not in the Talmud for whatever reason, which is a really interesting... Rabbi Abraham. Not that I can think of offhand. Nope. I'm sure there may be, but not that I can think of. If there is, there's not a well-known one. Not in the Talmud. And I don't know why Talmudic names work that way, but they do. And again, that's a name that became popular later, but not in the Talmud. So.
For whatever it's worth, I feel such a state down emotionally. Like,
between?
I'm about to cry. I don't know why. Maybe justice, like justice, and Ishmael, and Isaac. Like, I literally feel
sad. Well, it's true. I mean, I would say this. I'll say this in closing, which is, you know, there was a review this morning in the New York Times about a new book about the Mayflower by Nathan Philbrick. And it said basically, as you would expect from a modern historian, that most of what we know about the Mayflower is completely wrong, and that it wasn't at all the way that it seemed. And besides, Thanksgiving didn't even exist in the holiday till Abraham Lincoln made it one more than some 200 years later. The founding of peoples and nations is almost invariably a painful business. In fact, not almost, invariably a painful business. People get displaced. Other people get neglected. Societies come into friction and opposition and war, and that's the truth of it. Fairy tales are fairy tales, but the way the world actually works is very painful. And I would say maybe that's part of what the Bible is actually teaching, is that this is as peaceful a beginning as there could be, but in fact, if you don't cast Ishmael out, you'll never have a Jewish people. And it's just not true that you can always have perfectly peaceful means and still get a nation, which is a painful reality, but maybe a reality.